Peace be with you. Welcome to the Dean Show. For those that were with us last week, Hamza met Ted. Ted met Hamza, the human connection. We were sharing. Ted asked some questions. It was going really great. So this is the part two to that. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
This is the Dean Show. This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
This is the Dean Show.
Back here on the Dean Show, one of the unique things about the Dean Show is that along with sharing this message, clearing the misconceptions, we really define the words here. I want you to start off this session with Ted defining what is, because we've thrown around Muslim, Islam. What are these words? What do they mean? What does Islam mean?
Well, Islam essentially means the submission, the peaceful submission to God. And a Muslim is someone who peacefully submits to the will of God. He says, my will comes from my ego. God's will comes from something that transcends that. He is the source of peace, as-salam. He is the loving, he is the merciful. So I'm gonna submit my will to his will peacefully, and I'm gonna surrender to him. It's like almost letting go of your ego.
Sure.
And saying, you know what? It's about me and Allah and having that connection.
What if someone says, well, Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism mean the same thing? Can you actually say that?
Well, Buddhism, for example, and I used to be like a Buddhist. I used to love the Tibetan tradition.
You used to be a Buddhist?
Well, I used to get involved in the Tibetan tradition. My brother was very involved in this kind of agnostic Buddhist philosophy. It's very interesting. And there's some parallels with Buddhism and Islam based on, you know, thinking and tafakkur, reflection, and tadabbur, pondering. It's in the Islamic tradition where one scholar, Dr. Malik Badri, he basically says that maybe Buddhism was one of the monotheistic traditions and it was somehow over, you know, like, whispers, you know, when human beings whisper from one to another, it gets filled, you know, it gets...
Things change.
Things change.
Islam not very different, I'm assuming. That I would assume, and this is a gross assumption,
because
I didn't grow up and I haven't been around for 1600 years in this conversation, in that the Islam that was worked with, even in the medieval times, versus the conversation that is today, that just like everyone else, it has evolved to subsist. So, if I'm asking the question, if it's a question, much like Buddhism, was this the monotheistic thing? Yes, of course. What is the conception of what you see to come based on that where we've been?
Okay, it's a very good question.
Answer this question, just so real quick, just finishing so the people can understand, like, you define what Islam is. Is Buddha, named after Buddha,
yeah,
Christianity
exactly.
after Christos?
So, very good to bring me back to the point.
Oh, that's a great question,
so,
Eddie.
So Buddhism is an agnostic philosophy, meaning that there's one narration attribute to the Buddha, and someone says to him, does God exist? And he said, it's irrelevant, right? So basically the question of God and his relevancy is a non-question from that perspective, because Buddhism is an agnostic philosophy. Just work with your life, your mind. How do you break your ego? How do you live peacefully? Now, we would say actually the God question is a very important question,
sure,
because it grounds your morality, it grounds who you are, your sense of self, and all of these different things. Now, when it comes to Christianity, a Christian, basically, especially mainstream Christianity, they believe in something what you would call a Trinitarian conception,
sure,
of God.
The Christ event.
In the Greek language is homoousios. Mm-hmm. There's one essence, homoousia, essence, one essence, three distinct persons. Well, we would say humbly in the Islamic tradition, this doesn't befit the majesty and perfection of God, and this is not the correct conception of the divine. So for you to connect with that is like connecting with something other than the divine. So what we would say humbly is, if you want to go back to the roots, go back to even original Christianity, the original beliefs. So,
well, even further back.
Yeah, even the, like, Jewish tradition.
Way back.
Yeah. That you want to connect with God, there is no intermediary, no son, no book, no pope, nothing. It's a direct connection, a direct relationship. And that's why sometimes you have, you know, our brothers in Christianity saying, you know, how's your relationship with God? Do you have a loving relationship with God? I would humbly say, well, I don't think you do. Because maybe, you know, if you have to have something in the middle, is that a loving relationship? If I want to, like, fall in love with my wife, I'm not going to put my mom in the middle, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Or, you know, stop
Lord
playing
knows
with...
that's a horrible plan. It's never going to work.
Or play with my phone and talk to my wife. That's not going to work. Yeah.
So I'm going to connect straight to my wife. Just like with God, you want to have a loving relationship with God, you connect straight to Him. So that's what Islam's about. We connect with Allah. Right.
Was your question now, how do we know Islam hasn't changed?
Yeah, just like many of these. Preservation. Sure.
Preservation.
Well, I know here's some things that I've come to understand historically.
Sure.
And let's just look at the civilization, and it's basically been like a riding on a snowboard down a mountain. Mankind, right?
With a few avalanches,
from pretty significant ones, yes. So we drifted deeply into our first understandings of religion, and we had many, many things that we chose to choose as things we'd understand gods. There were animals. We wanted the amorphism. We had the pagan religions that there's an admiration of the animal world, and there's a lot of what we did in our lives at that time that was very animalistic.
Yeah, sure.
And then we come into what our philosophers began to say, hang on guys, we don't have a god of lightning, we don't have, and Greek mythology, and these great thinkers come to play and say, hey, hang on a second, too many divine beings here. We've got to get this down to something that's palatable and something we can live with. So that drifts into the next big swing and becomes a scientific pursuit via philosophy. Then it's swinging, it's up and down, it's drifting extremely towards the spiritual side, extremely towards the scientific side, and we have Darwinism that brings in this, like, well, if we can literally change the breed of dog and change the way flowers look, how is God in charge of everything if I can control the flowers that grow?
Yes, of course.
That's a fantastic question. It births some interesting things.
Okay, there's a few questions here, right?
Yeah, a lot, sorry.
Let's go back to the first question, which is, you know, when I mentioned about Buddhism and about the statements attribute to
sure.
him and the preservation and
sure.
stuff, Islam is like different. It's not based on a whispers philosophy. In the Islamic tradition, is called something called mutawatir or tawatur. It's an Arabic word. All mm-hmm. it means is recurrent reporting. And I'm going to try and give you a picture for you to put in your mind. Say you have the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he told something to five of his companions. And these five companions said exactly the same thing to their five companions.
Sure.
And each of these five companions that have five companions, they say to another five companions something else. So the chain grows. And you see that the chain of knowledge, not everybody has the same chain. So somebody has this chain, someone has this chain, some of these people never met before, they come from different times and places. But at the end of the chain, you have millions of people saying exactly the same thing.
Sure.
Now, philosophically speaking, to say that what they're saying now wasn't what the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, said, is tantamount to a mass conspiracy. That they somehow basically traveled, took a time machine, you know, said, make sure you say this, make sure you say that. You got it from this chain, and say you got it from that chain of narration.
Sure, sure.
So this basically shows that you can't deny what you call recurrent reporting. Even David Hume, famous Scottish sure. skeptic philosopher, he said, you know, if the masses of people in the 1600s, actually said that there was 8 days of darkness, and it was reported by everybody from different peoples and different times and places, then to deny this would be absurd. And he was a skeptic.
Certainly.
He even denied causality in a way, right?
Sure.
So this is an Islamic historical principle. And all of the prophetic traditions, and even the Quran, has come via this scientific method, or maybe that's the wrong word.
It is a scientific method.
This historical principle.
Sure.
So to deny a statement of the Prophet Muhammad that's authenticated, upon him be peace, and to deny the Quran is actually like denying Plato, Aristotle, World War I, World War II,
sure.
all the known history. So that's
right.
why we have a very preserved tradition.
It's very, very exciting. I don't want to cut them off, but we got to go to break. And we'll be right back with more here on The Dean Show. Don't go anywhere.
Please subscribe to The Dean Show. Follow us on our official Facebook and Twitter pages in the links below. Please also help support The Dean Show by making a donation in the link below.
Back here on The Dean Show, Hamza, tell us, in my studies in comparative religion, I have not found any other book that A, has been preserved, tamper-free, tamper-proof, like the Quran, preserved in the original Arabic language. With the challenge, as you stated earlier, if you find one contradiction God Almighty is saying in the Quran, then it can't be from God. But do you find any other book making the claim like it does? On every page, you see Allah, God's name mentioned.
Yes.
And you see that now it's claiming that, look, I am your creator. I created the universe. Try to disprove it. If you can't, then it's not from me. Do we find that in the Bible? Do we find that in Buddha?
I have not found it.
Have you?
From my limited knowledge, no.
And what's interesting about the Quran, you understand the point?
I do. Like the Quran basically makes a challenge, like a falsification test. It says in the second chapter, 23rd verse,
sure.
وَإِن كُنْتُمْ فِي رَيْبِ مِمَّا نَزَلْنَا عَلَىٰ عَبْدِنَا, and it continues. Basically, mm-hmm. if you're in doubt about this book we have sent down to our servant, referring to the Prophet Muhammad upon whom be peace, then bring one chapter like it, right? Also, the Quran says in the same chapter that if this wasn't from God, there'll be ikhtilaf and kathir, meaning many discrepancies. You know what's very interesting about this term, by the way, a little off, it's off the topic, but it relates. It says there'll be many discrepancies. So there's two things you could do. First, you could look at the whole of the Quran and see if there's any discrepancies. That's the first way. Or, if you're a logician, you could find out how many times the word discrepancy is mentioned. Ikhtilafan in that form is only mentioned once, which is quite interesting. Anyway, so the point here is...
That's smart.
It is very smart, right. So the thing with the Quran, it makes this challenge. It doesn't hide and say, just have blind faith. Just believe because I said so. It challenges mankind. It addresses man, it addresses Ted, how address should be addressed. You have a brain, you have a heart, use it. And God is saying, look, here's this text. It did come 1400 years ago. It's making amazing claims for itself.
Sure.
But it's saying, here's a challenge. If you don't believe this from the Creator, then discuss it, challenge it, engage with it. And what I would argue is that this forms the basis for a whole array of arguments and things that we can assert that this book is from the divine. Let me give you one very small one just to get the thinking going, right? The Quran was revealed over a 23-year period. This is a historical fact. It was revealed in piecemeal over 23 years for specific times and places. Then it was put together as Al-Kitab, as a book, as a physical text. Now, if it was revealed over a 23-year period for specific times and places, then I want to ask a question. How on earth does it have its structural and mathematical coherence? Take, for example, the second chapter. It has 286 verses. The chapter was revealed over a 9-year period, intensely over a 2-year period, right? Now, if you do a karate chop in the middle, you have the 143rd verse. Do you know what word you find? Middle. Now, this is interesting. Now, go to the third chapter. It says the likeness of Jesus is like the likeness of Adam. Because there was an argument from the Christians, right? That look, you know, he had no father, therefore his father's God, which we don't believe, right? And Allah is saying, wait a minute, but the likeness of Jesus is like the likeness of Adam. You believe in Adam, he had no father, but you don't say that God's his father. You say he was created by God, right? Now, the key word here is likeness. Because Adam is mentioned 25 times in the Quran, and so is Jesus mentioned 25 times in the Quran. You know what's interesting? Up to this verse, they're both mentioned 7 times each. And that for me is remarkable. Now, there's more. For example, if you go to the shortest chapter, Surah Al-Kawthar, which is only 3 lines, and remember the Quran says, bring one chapter like it. It has 10 lexemata. Lexemata are units of meaning. Mm-hmm. A unit of meaning is not just a word, you can have a preposition with a word, right?
Correct.
You have 10 units of meaning. What's interesting is each verse uses only 10 letters. And what's even more interesting is that the whole chapter uses only 10 letters once. Right? If you consider the Hamza as a partial letter, it's not a real letter, it's like a quasi letter. That's very interesting. And there are many more of these kind of structural features. So for me, the Prophet Muhammad upon whom be peace didn't have a computer, didn't have a calculator, he didn't even write things down. Now what's very interesting is that these verses were wrote over a 23-year period, yet we didn't have a computer, but it was compiled together to have this amazing structural coherence. For me, humbly, I don't think there's a naturalistic explanation. That's just one. Now there is another one. Take for example, revealing of lost historical knowledge. The Quran, many claims say it's borrowing from the Jewish tradition and the Bible, right? But this is false for one specific reason. The Bible mentions Pharaoh. The Torah mentions Pharaoh. The Quran mentions Pharaoh, big deal. But also the Quran mentions king for the leader of the Egyptians also. And it mentions it in a distinct way. It mentions Pharaoh at the time of Moses and Al-Malik, king, at the time of Yusuf, Joseph. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't conflate them, doesn't use...
There's no conflict there's in no the conflict, timeline.
Yes. But in the biblical tradition and the Jewish tradition, there's this conflict, right?
Oh, it's rampant from every single book.
Yeah, it's not accurate from that perspective.
Almost purposefully inaccurate.
Now this is a minute detail. If you were to take away this word, it wouldn't affect the message of the Quran. However, it remains distinct that it mentions Pharaoh for the time of Moses, king for the time of Joseph.
Sure.
But the question here is this. at that time, we had no access to the hieroglyphics, which was the pictorial language of the Egyptians. Mm-hmm. It was a dead language. We have no oral tradition, no historian, no culture that even knew that language at that period. It was dead.
Now, I have a question regarding that particular part. And this is the part that I don't even pretend to... First of all, I've learned a great deal about the Quran and just this very short, elegant explanation. Thank you for that. And in that, I'll add that I have never doubted the fact that it's amazing. In and of itself, as a creation, as a book, it's a fantastic demonstration. And I also, correct me if I'm wrong, is it not taught through song?
It's like a recital.
Thank you. A recital and song. Now, I didn't grow up in England. I have a year and a half, nearly two-year-old little girl. I have a song that I heard. There once was a duke from York who had 100 men.
Yes.
He marched them up to the top of the hill and then down to the bottom again. When they were halfway up, they were neither up nor down. And it's the same thing over
and over again. That's a good rendition.
Right? Yeah, I totally butchered it because, you know, I know I'm in a hurry. But
someone called 911. He's murdered
right,
the song.
I've completely committed a crime against that song, which would probably be my very first introduction to Islam. It's been very difficult for me to do it with any amount of elegance such as your own.
No, obviously.
I'm grateful for that.
We're going to take a break now, and we'll be right back with more for our last segment here on The Dean Show. Don't go anywhere.
Please subscribe to The Dean Show. Follow us on our official Facebook and Twitter pages in the links below. Please also help support The Dean Show by making a donation in the link below.
Back here on The Dean Show. Please, Hamza, go ahead and take off. You were explaining
about the historical
about
point.
The historical point.
So hieroglyphics was a dead language, and we found out the Rosetta Stone, which was a stone that enabled us to translate the hieroglyphics in, I think, the end of the 20th century. And when we understood the hieroglyphics, we find out that actually the Bible and the Torah are wrong and the Quran is accurate specifically. Because in the old Middle Kingdom, which was the time of Joseph, they were using the kind of title as the king for the leader of the Egyptians. And then the New Kingdom, which is the time of Moses, they started to call him the Pharaoh, which I believe means the great house. That's this distinct, minute detail. Now, where did the Prophet get his knowledge from, upon him be peace, when there was an ignorance of that knowledge, an absence of that knowledge? We can't find it anywhere in oral tradition or in textual tradition. We can't find it in historical books or even religious tradition. So the claim that he copied the Bible is quite interesting, because therefore, fine, maybe he copied the Bible, but then he corrected his mistakes. Well, I didn't know there were mistakes. And how, where did he get the correct information from? So that's another little signpost to accumulate. You have an accumulative case for the Quran. Another quick thing, and to be honest, I could mention 10 points, but we don't have time. But another thing is about the structural features of the Quran. Many of the chapters are in what you call ring composition. Now, you don't even need to know Arabic for this. Ring composition is like units of themes, categories of themes. Again, let's look at the second chapter, which is the largest chapter. It has theme A, theme B, C, D, E. Then you have D1, you have C1, you have B1 and A1. So you have this ring composition. A and A1 have a similar theme, B and B1 have a similar theme, C and C1 have a similar theme, D and D1 have a similar theme, and E is on its own. E mentions the present. Before E mentions the past, after E mentions the future, but yet you all have these similar themes, right?
Sure.
There's this ring composition, and each ring, each category, has its own ring composition as well. So it's structured based on meaning and structural themes. And for me, since this book was revealed over a 23-year period for specific times and addresses specific events, how on earth has it been developed in this structural way? It shows that the author knew the future, which again gives support to the fact that it's likely to be from the divine.
Is this possibly, and I ask this really curious at this point in time, is that is it not a possibility to have, because of being written over a 23-year span of time, that the ability to ascertain cyclical occurrences, much like the seasons, much like the growing of crops, much like the coming and going of leadership, much like the migration of crops and animals, that within this span of time, to write the accountants of up to a singular point and then also write the accountants of what they believe will come to pass based off of this evidence, having seen that cycle come to a close and the next natural thing for life to do is to repeat itself. Are we not seeing something potentially being described here in the Quran as the natural order of the cyclicality of life itself?
That's a good question. I think the only problem with that is that ring composition is not a new thing.
Well, we're, people, and I don't want to assume that they wrote that not having our education. We're definitely smart about the same things.
Sure. People in literature developed structures called ring composition.
Sure.
The only problem is it's almost impossible to develop ring composition if you're addressing new realities over your career of prophetic career, your religious career, if you like. Ring composition works if you make a story up, right? But this was events that happened, and there were verses that were addressing those specific events.
Okay.
Now, for it to have almost like a prearranged structure, it's as if you knew what events were going to happen, which was almost impossible.
Well, and we look down upon that today with someone that could tell us that in the year 2022, we're going to have this happen.
By the
or
way,
in the year, yet there is a prophetic notion to most of what's taught.
But by the way, we're not talking about the future. It's not prophecies. It's talking about if this happens, then do this, right?
Okay.
But yet, all of these verses were specific to context and time, many of them.
Okay,
right?
Now I get it.
Yeah,
okay.
So you have this ring composition.
It was almost a manual to, in response to these conditions in life, this is the best path to take.
And yet, it has this amazing structure over those rule of between three period. The other thing I want to mention is relevancy. Now, the Quran basically wants to address the human mind, the 7th century mind, the 15th century mind, and the 30th century mind.
Certainly.
And let me give you some examples to show the multi-layered and multi-leveled meaning of this book, which is phenomenal. Because if it was 7th century, it must have a 7th century language. But the Quran is so dynamic, it has almost a timeless language. And for me, it shows it came from a being that knows all knowledge. Take, for example, the word alaqa. Alaqa means blood clot or an embryo or something, or
certainly
part of the human development. And you can find it in chapter 23 verse 14. Now the word alaqa has five major meanings: blood in a general sense, a blood clot, a leech or worm, or clay that sticks to the hand, or something that clings. Now for the 7th century Arab, he knew that based on dissections and abortions, the embryo looked like a blood clot.
Certainly.
So the Quran is saying, look, you were this and now you're here. Look at the wisdom in the universe. There must be a creator. He deserves to be worshipped.
Certainly.
But if you fast forward in the 15th century, we develop the microscope. And we look into the microscope, day 20 to 25. What do we see? We see the embryo. It looks like a worm. Dr. Dale Lehman, in his book Anatomy Demystified, says it looks like a worm.
Which is another interpretation of the word.
Exactly. So it relates to that multi-leveled meaning. But then after, if you might not have a scientific meaning because science changes.
Sure.
So science could be wrong. Right?
Well, that's the whole point of science,
exactly,
is to test and prove and continue on.
Exactly, but this is the beautiful thing. Forget the empirical scientific understanding here. Take a spiritual understanding and say, well, maybe God is not talking about anything scientific. Maybe it's existential, referring to the self.
Being was here before our thought about being was here.
He's saying that we were leech. He's saying that you're like a parasite. You had a parasitic relationship with your mother. If you study embryology, you see that the baby drains the resources of its mother.
Certainly.
And the leech, if it were to be sucking my hand now, it drains my resources. It takes everything it needs from my blood. And from the get-go, both the leech and the embryo act in this parasitical way. Drains from the resources of its host, mother, my hand in this case. Now, what's very interesting, Professor Lord Winston from Imperial College University said exactly the same thing. He said, embryo and leech act in the same way. So it's as if the Quran is saying, hey you, Mr. Arrogant, Mr. Businessman, Mr. Think You Know It All, Mr. Self-Sufficient, you were dependent on your own mother. And ultimately your mother and everything in creation is dependent on God. So willfully and willingly, lower the wing of humility and mercy to your mother, because
certainly,
she peacefully and willingly and compassionately drained her resources for you. You are a leech. So there may be a spiritual perspective. Now, the reason I'm giving you these examples is because isn't it amazing and fascinating, although you have a limited scope of meaning for certain words in the Quran, that it addresses a 7th century mindset, a 15th century mindset, and a 21st century mindset. For me, that's a dynamic text, and that's very important. Let me just give you one final example. One final example. The Quran says that the sun and the moon have their own orbits, right? They swim. The word is yasbahuna. Now you can look into the universe as with your naked eye as a 7th century Arab with sandals and say, wow, they're swimming in the cosmos. But that can also relate to celestial mechanics. They have on its own orbit. But you may be thinking, the sun has its own orbit? Yes, the 7th century Arab believed that the sun was going around the earth, which is wrong. But it addresses their mentality.
Well, so that was a hiccup in time.
Well, it's not even that. It's to address their mentality to make them realize there's power and wisdom in the universe. But you know what's very interesting? The sun does have its own orbit, according to modern physics.
Oh, modern physics has broken it out.
It orbits the Milky Way, and it takes 226 million years to orbit. And if you look at amazing diagrams of the universe, the sun is doing this orbit, and there's things, and the planets are going around it. It's phenomenal. So do you understand one word addresses a 7th century mindset, 15th and 30th, and any century mindset? So for me, it seems to me, when you add all these accumulative things together, plus the life of the Prophet Muhammad upon him, peace, which is another question and maybe another show, then it should make you think and say, what's the best explanation for this?
We're almost out of time. We got 1 minute left. Closing comments and advice to those truth seekers, people who are curious like Ted, and let's say someone out there is hearing this. What is that first step? Because we know that in Islam, you know, it's a lifetime struggle to acquire knowledge. There's so much. It's an ocean of knowledge. But when somebody wants to do Islam, they want to accept Islam, what is the first major step that one has to take?
Well, what they have to do is affirm the truth reality. You have an amazing tie. Islam is like saying that you have an amazing tie. And that's why we're saying we're affirming the reality that you have an amazing tie. And what is the affirmation of reality here? La ilaha illallah Muhammadan Rasulullah. There is no deity, no object worthy of worship but the one that created us, the deity, Allah. And the Prophet Muhammad, upon whom be peace, is his final messenger. Now this should be made with your heart, that you sincerely believe in this and that you have a willingness to worship. If you don't have that willingness to worship, which is your raison d'être, as the French say, your reason for existence, then that might not be accepted. So you have a willingness to worship, to come close to God, and you believe in that reality, and that makes you a Muslim. And
that's
simple. You don't have to know all this complex stuff I was talking about.
You don't have to go dip in a pool, you don't have to do anything.
You don't need angels to come down with fireworks or anything. It's so, yesterday, on Friday, we're here, there was a sister, American sister, sat through the lecture, came up to me and said, I want to become Muslim, but I don't know what's going on. She thought there has to be a special time and moment. I said, look, Allah wants you to love Him, but you've closed the door on Allah. You've locked the door, put the gates up and put guard dogs. Allah wants you to love Him. There's nothing special. Do you like this guy's shoes? Yeah, I like his shoes. Islam is just like that. You're accepting a reality. There is no deity worthy of worship. I'm not my deity. Society is not my deity. My boss is not my deity. Eddie is not my deity. Ted's not my deity. The ism and schism is not my deity. My deity is the one who created me, the one that loves me, the one that knows me better than I know myself. And I'm going to submit to that. And I'm going to love Allah, and He wants to love me. So why would I choose hell over a loving God? God doesn't send you there. Allah says, don't blame me. Blame your own hands. It's the spiritual cause and effect. So Allah is saying, just from your free will, make the right choice. And I told her, unlock the door, remove the dogs, take away the gate, open the door, and just embrace the love of Allah. She became a Muslim on Friday. It was beautiful, right? And that's the advice to everybody. Life is simple. We complicate it sometimes with egocentrism and philosophy and all this rubbish, but it's just simple. You were made. This is very basic instinct. It's a rational principle. You are made by something that's supernatural. He sent down a message, and we have good reasons to believe in it. You submit to His will, and you're at peace. You're not a slave to anybody. You're not a service to anyone apart from God. And if you're in service to God, you're in service to mankind. You create justice and peace and harmony. And then you die, then you have eternal bliss in paradise. And that's what we want for everybody. And that's Islam.
We're out of time. We're going over our time. Any closing comments?
Ted,
stay who you are. I think you've taught us a lot, because it shows to everybody, the Muslims, that we could come together and have these discussions, like we're in a coffee shop, chilling out, discussing about man, life, and the universe. And I'm going to connect with you after this anyway, because, you know, we had a long conversation before we had this show. And you're a great guy. Keep up the fitness and the nutrition and all the stuff that you do. Keep up the reading. And let's engage further. And that's what we have to do. We have to show people, we have to transcend the Fox News narrative. Now, they want to divide us. People want to divide us. We want to say we want a space where we could have the right emotions, the right intellectual discussions, the right human connection, so we could talk about these issues. And if we disagree with love. We don't disagree with hate. And that's what we want, Eddie, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Touch.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. And we'll see you next time here on The Dean Show. Hope you enjoyed. Peace.
Please subscribe to The Dean Show. Follow us on our official Facebook and Twitter pages in the links below. Please also help support The Dean Show by making a donation in the link below.